Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Jocelyn Brown, sitting in for Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about Heat Rock, you know, an album that's so hot it burns its way into our eternal memories. Today, we will be stepping back to 1981 to revisit the album It Must Be Magic by Tina Marie. Look, we're not trying to claim that California invented the sound of boogie. There's any number of cities in contention here, but it's hard to deny the role of the West Coast, especially here in LA, with popularizing that particular mesh of soul and funk in the post-disco proto-hip-hop era of the early 1980s. Few artists, least of all few women, are as associated with that sound as the object of today's conversation. Marie-Christine Brockert, better known to the world as Tina Marie. She came into the game with vocal talent to spare, a powerhouse soprano with a 5-octave range, and she was also a multi-instrumentalist and a producer, arranger, and writing. All those talents went into a string of hit albums that continue to hold weight today. She was also, for better or for worse, known as one of the great blue-eyed soul singers, which is a rather euphemistic way of saying that she was a white woman in a black music world. But unlike others who might have been given the side eye as outsiders, Marie has seemingly earned a cosign that has never wavered throughout the years. And though she died well before her time, a little over 10 years ago, she is still now, as she was then, the undisputed queen of the boogie down.
It Must Be Magic was the album pick of our guest today, DJ, curator, and record collector Megan Pattison, better known to many as DJ Mama Bear. Megan is the host of one of my favorite radio shows, The Honeypot, on Dublab. She is a well-traveled DJ and member of world-renowned DJ collective Sweater Funk, focusing primarily upon boogie, future funk, and modern soul during their infamous parties. Megan also serves as a music curator for Uncanned Music, a company that creates music experiences in hospitality spaces. She's beloved by many, myself included, and we're happy to have her with us. Megan Pattison, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you. So I have to start with, you know, the big burning question. What was your introduction to Tina Marie?
Oh, well, for me, I was introduced to Tina Marie as a little girl. I grew up in Ontario, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And growing up in a predominantly Black and Latino neighborhood, I grew up listening to lowriders passing by and the music played at the roller rinks. So I'd have to attribute my first listen of Tina Marie to my good friend Angela and her family. Their family was big into roller skating. And so whenever I hung out at their house or was dragged to the roller rink, or I shouldn't say dragged, I happily went to the roller rink with them. That's where I first heard Tina Marie in the rink, at their house, during the cookouts, when she was getting her hair braided, all that. That's where I first was introduced to Tina Marie, but I didn't really sink my teeth into her catalog until college.
Shout out to roller rinks, and just as a point of introduction to music, which is something I don't want to get all generational about it, but that is a very particular kind of generational exposure because, I mean, it was a big place in which you could hear music being played because a lot of them had DJs.
Yeah. And also it was, it kept me busy. Like my mom gave me $8 and I was occupied for 8 hours, you know, and I got my energy out as a little, you know, in a little workout, and I was able to listen to music I otherwise wouldn't hear at home. So I still skate to this day. I'm looking at my skates right now and they're a little dusty, but nevertheless, you could do it indoors, outdoors, and still listen to music, even if it's on your own Walkman or personal music player.
Important question. Can you skate backwards?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm jealous. I'm so jealous right now.
I can shoot the duck. I can backwards skate, crossover. Oh yeah. I do more outdoor skating obviously right now, but yeah, once you learn, it's like muscle memory.
Skate. Megan, you mentioned that you got deeper into Tina Marie during college. So what happened then?
Yeah, so in college, I moved to San Francisco. I went to San Francisco State. And, you know, I loved the music and I wanted to do something different with it. I had played trumpet as a child, but had left that. And so it actually happened by accident. Literally, I got hit by a car driving my scooter in San Francisco. And I took the guy who hit me to court and settled. And with the settlement money, I bought a pair of 1200s, Technique 1200s, a Vestax, a really basic Vestax mixer, and a crate of Cameron Paul Mix-It comps.
Oh, you are taking me back right now.
I mean, I...
Okay, wait, I got to know, where did you copy your equipment and records from back then?
Okay, so back then I got my turntables off Craigslist when it wasn't as shady. Bought the Vestax mixer from a friend of a friend and the crate of comps off of a guy on Market Street in front of World of Stereo.
There you go.
And so this guy was, you know, the Mix-It comps, you know, Cameron Paul was a huge influential DJ in SF, as I'm sure you know, Oliver. And these comps were great because I wanted to learn how to DJ, but I also needed to rock a party with a volume of sounds. And so I revisited the music I loved so much, that funk, that 80s R&B. And those records are like dollar bin bangers. You know, I could afford to buy One Way and Zap and Evelyn Champagne King, including Tina Marie, because there were so many records in circulation, it was affordable for me. And that's when I listened to the album cuts of a Tina Marie record, beyond Square Biz and Behind the Groove and things like that. And I really got to know the record on a deeper level because I had to ask myself, could I play these tunes on a dance floor? And as well as home listening, but I just dug deep. I really, really sunk my teeth once I became a DJ myself.
So, Jocelyn, how did you get introduced to Tina Marie?
You know, I think I first recall having heard Tina Marie during the Lover Girl era, where that song was a hit and it was kind of everywhere. And I do remember my mom singing Square Biz in the car, you know, quite frequently, which was a lot of fun. But I it was really just kind of close to home sort of listening relative to Tina's catalog, for sure. How about you?
It had to have been Square Biz, and it almost certainly would have come through growing up in L.A. in the 80s listening to K-Rock, because Tina Marie's music would get programmed on there. Though in hindsight, I'm trying to think about why, because given that her lane was very much in the kind of R&B lane and K-Rock was supposed to be a modern rock station, I actually don't know why they would have Square Biz necessarily. But I mean, K-Rock had a pretty expansive playlist. I mean, my introduction to hip-hop came through K-Rock in a lot of ways too, so I guess it wasn't that surprising. But I got to say, I never picked up, and still have not to this day, I've never picked up any of her albums or records. We'd need to go back downstairs and look through my DJ crates to make super sure about this. But even though I've always been aware of Tina Marie, I guess I never really got into her music per se. So I'm actually really looking forward to today's conversation as being a bit of a crash course lesson. And on that note, Megan, can you tell us, why is it that you picked It Must Be Magic of all of her albums? What makes this particular title a heat rock for you?
So this album is a heat rock for me because I believe this was the moment when Tina first truly started to take full creative control over her own product. You know, it wasn't her first album. It was actually her fourth and last on Motown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's commonly assumed that Rick James was responsible for much of her success, but this record proves that she could make it on her own. You know, she produced it entirely. She wrote it entirely. The arrangement, she was already an accomplished singer, but the whole package of this album just proves that she is completely okay on her own. And her intentions are just really clear on this record. She has no intentions of making this a specific genre record because this isn't a dance record. I couldn't play this from start to finish at a club. It's not a Quiet Storm record because of the smash dance hits. And she's going to control it entirely on her own. And also the fact she's making clear, you know, the color of her skin is not going to define the type of music she makes. So to me, this record feels more like a soundtrack to a musical than, say, a dance record. And I love the fact that it was her, you know, highest selling, most successful record during her entire tenure. And she did it exactly the way she wanted to do it.
I was thinking in prepping for today how, you know, Tina Marie, one of the nicknames that she was given was the Ivory Queen of Soul, which is really just a fancy way of saying she's a white girl singing R&B music, right? Mm-hmm. But in this regard, I think she is different from earlier blue-eyed soul singers like Dusty Springfield, but also different from contemporary white artists who record at least occasionally within R&B, someone like Ariana Grande, for example. Tina Marie seems to me more similar to like a Bobby Caldwell in the sense that, number one, a lot of people had no idea that they were white. And number two, once they learned, they didn't care. In fact, I would say that Tina Marie is the most celebrated and least controversial white R&B artist of all time, though I have no idea quite why that is. But it's just something where she kind of just gets this eternal pass, and the fact that she's white and singing R&B, people are like, okay, that's cool. And then just move on to talk about something else. Mm-hmm. Meg, I would love your thoughts on this.
Well, I think, you know, having to do with where she grew up in Venice Beach, also known as Venice Harlem, like the particular Oakwood neighborhood where she grew up, she's been artistically honest since the very beginning. She always stuck to that. She's always pays tribute to, you know, Etta James and other Black singers that kind of formed her. Al Green being one of like the most pivotal moments for her, watching him boogie in hot pants on Soul Train. It was undeniable. She was not faking the funk whatsoever. It was just in her. And I think because she maintained that throughout her entire career, she stayed true to it, that it was just really, really authentic. And, you know, with Lover Girl, that I think was probably the only time she crossed over to the white audience. But she continued to make music after that, was still true to Tina. And I don't think she ever had a hit after that that really crossed over the way Lover Girl did. So, you know, her music has been emotive since the very beginning. Like, so emotive that before you could see her on a music video or social media and just the saturation of that, people assumed she was Black. And then when they saw her, like you said, it was just, oh, like on the Lady T record, she must be Spanish, you know, like she can't be vanilla. But she never said she was anything else. She always, you know, I just love how authentic she was from the very beginning. And you can hear that in her music up until the day she passed away.
I think one of the famous stories about how Motown, when they initially put her music out, was for her first album, I guess it was Berry Gordy, very strategically opted not to put her photo on the cover, which would have been very, you know, conventional at the time. And instead it was more of an like clouds or something like that, partly because he didn't want people to see that she was white. But then for the second album, which was what, Lady T, right? You got a full, you know, full face portrait. And that was sort of the big revelation. And again, people were like, oh, wow. Okay, cool. And then again, just move back to the music instead.
Well, and even after the fact, you know, there are interviews that you can read where she basically says, you know, even well after Lady T and on into the 80s and 90s, she would do shows and fans would come up to her afterward and say, I had no idea you were white, you know. And I think going back to what we said about why is she able to be so well loved and celebrated and least controversial, I have a bit of a theory, and I have some thoughts about this. But to be a woman, you know, on the roster at Motown, you kind of had to be able to give as good as you got. And especially in her case, where she's dealing with Rick James and Berry Gordy at the same time and fighting for her work and her right to be a songwriter, be a multi-instrumentalist and be a producer on her works. All of that matters. And I think the listening public, they felt that struggle come through in her song, but they also sensed a lot of joy too. And that level of duality, frankly, you know, struggles, joy, as Frankie Beverly once said, joy and pain, you know, Black America knows about that. And we relate to that. And that's critical.
Art is long and life is short. My euphonic heartache. Do I brag, complain, or sport? It's not enough to say you care. No, you've got to spread the word. Have you heard?
When we think about this particular time period, you know, disco has kind of had its heyday. New wave is emerging in the aftermath of punk, and R&B seems to kind of be smoothing out a little bit. There are all these different musical shifts happening within the recorded music world. Where do you think Tina Marie fits into this puzzle, specifically when we think about her work once she's out on her own?
You know, this album came out in 81, and for me, that's the sweet spot, personally. That's years 80 to 85 were my particularly favorite era for, you know, boogie music or R&B music, however you want to call it. So she's coming out after disco, like post-disco, you know, I guess you could say disco died in 79. But it was before electro really kicked in, or kind of like drum machines were prevalent in all kinds of music. So I think her presence during that time was one of, you know, a combination of things. She wanted to have a good time with the dance tracks, but she also wanted to talk about sociopolitical things. She also wanted to drop an opus about Jesus. You know, she was going to do what she wanted to do, and it didn't matter what was popular on the charts. She did it.
And there's a lot going on for her around this time, too. You know, this album became her first gold record, and she's producing. She's arranging for and playing with people like Patrice Rushen and Gerald Albright during these sessions. Mm-hmm. And she's eventually nominated for a Grammy for this mm-hmm. album, Best Female R&B Vocal in 1982. And then something, you know, kind of odd happens. Motown starts to hedge, and they don't really want to let her record or release any new music. And she calls that out from jump. You know, she calls it onto the carpet, seeks legal representation, and they take it to court. And the courts eventually rule in her favor, and a law gets passed called the Brockert Initiative that basically states, you know, no record label has a right to lock an artist into a recording contract or refuse to release their music after a certain amount of time. And several of her contemporaries go on to benefit from that ruling. I think Mary Jane Girls and Luther Vandross are just two of the artists who have served to benefit from that, but she's an innovator even in that right, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, imagine what torture to hold an artist back in making music. Like you're stuck. You have to stay on the label, but you can't make records, you know? And so I know this initiative helped George Michael too, Tom Petty. It was really trailblazing at the time and something she probably had no idea she was getting herself into, but was just so passionate and true to herself that she was going to make it work. And, you know, what a great way to bow out of Motown with her highest selling record, a gold record, and just kind of bid farewell and move on to what she wanted to do, which was make more music.
One of the things that I love most about Tina Marie's work is that you get a sense of who she is as a whole. You know, it's like you said earlier, there are songs about the party life, but there's plenty there that leans towards the spiritual, the political, and the romantic. And thinking about her work in this way, what stands out to you?
I think going back to why I think this is a heat rock is because she touches all of those topics. You know, she's not going to be confined. And what a beautiful thing for the public to embrace it and celebrate it and not just say, hey, where's my dance record? You know, there's just so much more to her. There's so much depth to her.
I think along those lines, especially off this album in particular, I wasn't expecting a song like Revolution. And just again, to give context, I'd never listened to this album from front to back before. So certainly wasn't expecting it. And I'm like, oh, this is a song literally about, you know, political social revolution. The other thing about this song that stuck out in listening to it is, and it's not like I went and double-checked this, but it's got to be one of the first times someone name-checks eating at a sushi bar in a song. And this is 1981, 82, right? That's kind of early to be on the sushi trend. So, you know, shout out for Tina Marie out there, you know, have sipping sake at sushi bars and being early on the scene with that. So, yeah. We need a moral contribution, 'cause any old
revolution won't do. A revolution, a revolution won't do. When I think about her work, and I think this is true of a lot of people, I tend to lean toward her romantic side, the ballads. You know, I love the party songs and I love her witty side and even her humorous side. But the way she emotes with these ballads, you're like hearing the whole arc of a relationship in a vocal run. And I think about this specifically relative to Portuguese Love. All the story. There's a whole novel right there in just those two lines. And I have to say, in listening to this particular version that's on the album, the LP version is very, very different from the radio edit that most of us have come to know. And there are so many changes throughout this one song that it feels like you're listening in on a three-act play.
Yeah, I think it's a disservice to listen to the radio edit, personally. You want to listen to the 7-minute just burn, you know, and enjoy the ride, enjoy the journey. Was it so familiar calling soft my name? Sunlight
dancing slowly through love's window pane. It's definitely a journey. And speaking of which, you know, I want to take a minute to think about place as a driver of feeling in this album. Specifically on the track, Where's California? As somebody who's lived in different cities and returned to California, does that track resonate with you and how so?
Oh, of course. I mean, that was a track that I actually kind of skipped over first listen. But when you listen to the thing about being from California, as much as it could be annoying or the congestion or the traffic or whatever you want to complain about, when you don't live in California, you miss it. You miss the beach. You miss In-N-Out. You miss, there's all these things that are very California specific. And so I feel her in that track. I mean, to be in a place, I think she's talking about a lover in England or something in Manchester. And she just wants to be back home, Venice Beach, because that's where she grew up. And that's what feels comfortable to her. And what two different places, you know, foggy, rainy England compared to sunny California. So there are hundreds of tracks written about California for good reason. You don't hear many tracks about Wyoming necessarily, or no offense to Wyoming, anybody from there, but California, it's a place and it's a place for good reason.
The shots at Wyoming, unexpected here.
I know. I'm sorry, Wyoming, but you know, it doesn't evoke such sentiment.
Right.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Megan Pattison on It Must Be Magic after a brief word from our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Stay tuned.
Hey folks, it's me, James Arthur M., host of Minority Corner, your home through these wild times for weekly doses of pop culture, history, news, nerdy stuff, and more through a BIPOC queer and allied lens.
Y'all, we have been in a panorama for a whole year.
The Ponder replay has been going for... We've been a Ponderosa for a year.
Wonder Woman doesn't even get to fly her own invisible jet. That was another thing. I was like, this is your jet.
Think about the war on drugs. We must think of it as a war on black and brown and poor people to only uphold the caste system of America. So join me and some of your new BFFs every Friday here on Maximum Fun to stay informed, empowered, and have some fun. Minority Corner, because together we're the majority.
Are you feeling elevated levels of anxiety? Do you quake uncontrollably, even thinking about watching cable news? Do you have disturbing nightmares, only to realize it's 2 in the afternoon and you're up? If you've experienced one or more of these symptoms, you may have FNO, news overload. Fortunately, there's treatment. Hi, I'm Dave Holmes, host of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters helps fight FNO. That's because Troubled Waters stimulates your joy zone. On Troubled Waters, two comedians will battle one another for pop culture supremacy. So join me, Dave Holmes, for two doses of Troubled Waters a month. The cure for your news overload. Available on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on Heat Rocks talking about Tina Marie's It Must Be Magic with DJ and curator Megan Pattison.
So Megan, just to pick back up where we left off, you and I came to know one another after you'd moved to Chicago in 2010, quickly making a name for yourself as a DJ around town. What is it about boogie, soul, and funk music that appeals to you as a DJ?
As a kid, I loved skating to it, because I could dance and skate at the same time. I mean, my parents listened to like New Wave and K-Rock, like Oliver had mentioned, like Oingo Boingo, that was my stuff played at the home, and a little Earth, Wind & Fire and Kool & the Gang, that was crossover. But you cannot help but dance to a boogie record, to a funk record. It's cross-generational. You know, when I play a party that has people of different ages and I feel like I'm floundering, I could put on Frankie Beverly and the place erupts. I can put on Tina Marie and the place erupts. So I think it touches a lot of different people from different ages. But, also from a DJ perspective, I could rock a party in a fairly inexpensive way, because when I started DJing, you know, I couldn't afford a $12.99 hip hop single. That was one song to play at a club. I needed to make my dollar stretch. So buying these albums allowed me to, play records to rock a party, but also I loved how it made me feel. A boogie, which is kind of like a specific subgenre of funk music or R&B, is flirty. I really love how flirty it is. I love how the message in the music is positive for the most part. And even when it isn't positive, it's optimistic. So, you know, there are some tunes during that boogie era that were socially inclined, talked about the state of affairs. But for the most part, it's about dancing, hollering at people, flirting, having a good time, looking good, smelling good, hitting the town. And that's what I want to listen to when I'm dancing. That's what I try to channel when I'm ready to go out at night, is that type of vibe, that type of energy.
I mean, since we're going down this road, when I started DJing also in the Bay Area in the 90s, probably around the same time you started, Megan, boogie simply was not a common theme that an entire party would have been organized around. I mean, yeah, people like myself and others I knew, we would throw in a little Rick James or Mary Jane Girls. But again, we're not building an entire night out of that sound. And it wasn't until, for me at least, probably the mid-late aughts, that I began to see boogie parties beginning to jump off. And that was then followed by this huge spike in people, DJs and collectors, just chasing after boogie records and 12 inches. So I'm wondering, Megan, as someone who was there more or less at the ground floor, what do you think about how the popularity of boogie has grown?
Tremendously. I mean, there's a boogie section at record stores now. You know, like when boogie is attached to a record on eBay, the prices can be higher. You know, like Discogs, boogie, 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 boogie. And some people have you know, opinions about the term boogie. I use it as an easy way to describe the music that I like to listen to from underdiscovered artists that came out between 80 and 85, you know, and some people might disagree with me on that, but it's definitely attributed to Dame Funk. He is the reason why Sweater Funk exists. The founder of Sweater Funk would go to Funkmasphere as a guest, and he was inspired to create a Bay Area version of Funkmasphere, also known as Sweater Funk. And the fact that Dame was always so open about telling people what the records were, because at this time when we were playing Boogie heavily, 2009, 2010, Shazam didn't exist. So the only way you could find out a tune was if you asked the DJ and if they were kind enough, where Dame was like, don't even worry about coming up to the booth, I'll say it on the microphone. And so people started taking notes and, you know, just the online collection of it. It's for me, it's able to, you know, offer access to what was like affordable because people didn't know it. A lot of times as a DJ, you want to play records that people know because it gets them into it. They want to run to the dance floor. They want to sing along. And as a DJ, that feels good. To play a record that nobody knows, it's scary. You will clear a dance floor and you kind of have to build up a thick skin as a DJ that you might clear a dance floor. But with our party Sweater Funk, we kept it cleared for years, with the exception of DJs, us, because there were a lot of us in the crew where we would throw down a record and do 2 for 2, 3 for 3, and then go dance and just rotate. But then eventually other people enjoyed it and liked it. And, you know, Funkmasphere was putting out mixtapes at the time. So there was not only people selling the records, but Funkmasphere and Sweater Funk mixtapes were floating around. And then other more well-known artists like DJ Haircut, who is now known as Mayor Hawthorne, Chromeo, they started touching upon it and it reached the masses. And, you know, and then Dame Funk comes out with a record with Snoop Dogg, you know, 7 Days of Funk. So it's way more popular. People are realizing how much fun it is and how it's created just a name for itself.
I have to ask, what would you say is your fire track from this album?
Well, I'd have to say It Must Be Magic. You know, it's the first track on the album. It's the name of the album. She goes in hot and hard. She arranged this album herself. So she's like out the gate is letting everybody know this is going to kind of reel you in. It's absolute joy. This song really it epitomizes what was going on during that time. In the 80s, what attracted me to this music in the beginning. She's talking about being in love. It's magical. She has fun, you know, voices going on in the back. I don't know if it's a genie or what is going on, but she's having fun. She's happy. And you cannot help but have that rub off on you.
That was also my choice, which bucks the trend of me usually picking the most obvious choice, which would have been, in this case, I think, Square Biz. Mm-hmm. But again, listening to this album for the first time, I thought Square Biz would end up being my fire track. But I think because for a lot of the reasons that you just stated, Megan, it was the title track. And it certainly helps that it comes in first. And not only is it the first song, but just the horn section and the way that it just leaps out from the very moment you put this record on, I think left a huge impression on me.
You know, I think that my answer would have to be Square Biz. And yes, it's an obvious choice because it's upbeat. It's a very fun song. I'm choosing it for one very specific reason. She's telling the world exactly who she is through an emerging art form, rap. And she's addressing all of the questions that people now have surrounding her identity. You're a white girl in this space. What are you doing? And she's telling them. And she's doing it respectfully and doing it masterfully, I might add.
Don't you have no doubt, I'm gonna spell it out. I'll hit you to the T, that is. I got the best, the most, baby, from coast Yeah, I mean, if you think about 1981 and what was going on, like Sugar Hill Gang came out with Rapper's Delight. But beyond that, rap was far from being a staple on the radio. You know, and white people were definitely not making any sort of significant dent in that chart. But she comes out like guns blazing and almost like calls people out. You know, I think Rapture came out that year as well. And she heard Debbie Harry's rap. And she says in the song, she's like, I've heard other ladies rap, but they ain't got nothing on me. She kind of calls them out. I mean, that's guts. And she explains, like, I do like filet mignon, and I also like cornbread, and I like greens. And I listen to all sorts of things, Sarah Vaughan and Bach. And she's really making a statement in that rap, in case anybody didn't know that.
How about favorite moments off of this LP? And for me, this is something that Megan also mentioned. This is off of It Must Be Magic. And I describe it as the P-Funk Chipmunk sound. It's kind of the voices, right, that comes in on the hook. And the reason why this lingers to me as a moment is, number one, I wasn't expecting it. And the style of it, to me, connects a song that clearly on a musical level is riffing off of a lot of post-disco influences and reconnects it, you know, practically, well, I don't know, maybe at least half a decade to the sound of classic 70s disco through that high-pitched chipmunky, you know, when you think about the Ohio Players' grandma, you know, voice, there's a lot of music from the 70s that all have that kind of high-pitched caricature voice going on with it. And so for this to end up coming back into It Must Be Magic, for me, it was just a really pleasant surprise. And as I'm saying, connects the lineage of this song back to a slightly earlier era of disco. Jocelyn, how about you?
You know, I would have to say there's a choral part in the song 365 where she steps behind the beat a little bit with her vocals, and you'll hear it repeatedly throughout the song. I wasn't expecting that play, you know, with time and rhythm, but it's masterful and it's almost theatric in the way that she does it. It's just this brief little slip of vocalization, but it makes that entire song something special.
Yeah, that song almost, I feel like if that song got more play, it could be almost like an electric slide anthem. Like, yeah, at a family party or something, or at a barbecue. Like there's hand claps in it, you know, and it's joyous and it's uplifting. So I think maybe somebody can make a little Cupid shuffle out of it or something.
I'm inclined to agree. And, you know, there's something really sweet and rewarding just hearing someone who sings as well as Tina Marie does sing about workaday, everyday love. It's nothing spectacular and over the top. It's just simple appreciation for the fact that that partner is there, but it's done in such a way that you can't not pay attention to that song.
Mm-hmm. Megan, do you have any favorite moments off of this album?
I'd have to say the album starts off with It Must Be Magic. Like I said, going in hot and hard, kind of telling everybody who she is. But then she finishes the record with Yes Indeed, which she brings Patrice Rushen on to play the keys. And at that point, I don't think Patrice had been dabbling much in the R&B world. You know, she was still doing a lot of jazz stuff. But you could hear how much she loves jazz on that record. And it's almost like, if you think about like The Last Call, when I was DJing in clubs, I had a Last Call anthem. I had a Last Call song, which it was something that would kind of like ease you out into the night, ease you out to go pay your bar tab. So you weren't left high and dry, but I wasn't also going to keep your heartbeat up. So she almost has like a last call song in this album. And so for me, Yes Indeed was really my surprising favorite moment of the record.
Follow up with that, because I was going to ask, you know, what is your slow burner track on this album? You know, the track that took a while to grow on you. And for me, that was my slow burner track, Yes Indeed, because you're listening to that song and it almost feels too personal. Like you feel like you might be listening in on a phone call you have no business hearing. And you can tell that she has lived every word of what she's singing in that song. As I've listened over time, I've come to love it for that reason. So back to the question. What would you say is your favorite slow burner on this album?
So for me, Where's California is my favorite slow burner, because when I was first learning how to dig records and I was like at a listening station, for instance, at a record store, I would get a stack of records and I would start at the beginning of the record and listen to like the first 30 seconds, then the middle for the break, and then the end, and see, can I play this at a club? I was just in club mentality. Could I play this for a party? And so, yes, I could play the dance tunes, It Must Be Magic and Square Biz, but I completely skipped over Where's California because the intro is very slow. It's maybe a little boring, you know? But once you get into the harmonies and once you hear what she's going through and how much she's yearning, it was one of those that I had to listen to on repeat to fully and truly appreciate it. Ain't no truth in the believing.
Three words you would use to describe this album to someone who's never heard it before.
Oh, okay. So three words. Cinematic, for sure. Emotive. And then for number three, I would say passionate.
Well, before we cut out of here, we always want to leave our audience with something dope to step to next. And so we have some recommendations. I'm going to start with one that's super self-serving, but we did mention his name earlier. One of our earliest episodes here in Heat Rocks, going all the way back to episode number 5, aired in the fall of 2017, was with Dame Funk. And he wanted to talk about the album Miracles by the group Change. And so I think if you enjoyed today's convo, you should definitely go back, check out the album, and then check out our conversation with Dame Funk about that album. If you wanna make this feeling stay, hold tight. Hold tight. Don't let this moment fade away. Hold tight. Jocelyn, how about you?
I'm gonna step aside and call out an album that's kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's Annette Peacock's I'm the One. It's on that opposite end of the spectrum in that it's not clearly R&B or funk music. It's living pretty firmly in experimental jazz territory. But on this particular album, Annette Peacock borrows from both of those genres pretty heavily. And there's definitely a lineage between both these artists to me where songwriting, lived experience, and emotiveness are concerned. There's a track on that album, Pony, that seems like it could potentially live in Tina Marie's world, too. Megan, how about you?
So I'd have to say, without a doubt, the band Ozone, which was also signed to Motown at the same time as Tina. And they even played on a couple of Tina Marie tracks. They backed her on Chains from Irons in the Fire. And I learned about ozone through Sweater Funk. And it was crazy because when I was at the Sweater Funk party for one of the first times, I thought that was a Tina Marie track and I'd never heard it before. But when the vocals came in, it was a male vocalist. And so I learned more about ozone and how they served back up to like Billy Preston and Sarita. They even played on a Bobby Nunn track. She's just a groupie. But two songs in particular, rather than the album, I would say is Our Hearts Will Always Shine by Ozone, because it has strings, making it really lush, which is something Tina always did. But then it also has that really nasty bass line that slaps. And it's super sentimental and uplifting. So it's a love song that's very optimistic. So definitely Our Hearts Will Shine. Our Hearts Will Always Shine by Ozone. And then another track by them, which is kind of just like Tina, you know, she has some very sentimental love songs, but then she also has some funky dance hits. The song Strut My Thang by Ozone, which the first mix I ever made in life was titled Strut My Thang, inspired by this song because it is sassy. It is charged. I mean, I tell that to myself, like I'm going to strut my thang tonight. It's super flirty. It's the bass line is also super nasty too. So those two songs by Ozone, if you like Tina Marie, you will definitely like those tunes. Good, but that's no surprise. When you're hot, yeah, yeah. Feel like I wanna strut my thing. Feel like I wanna.
Well, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Megan Pattison, DJ Mama Bear. What are you working on right now? And can you tell us where we can find you?
Yes. So I am happy to say that I'm still doing my radio show on Dublab, which is an online radio station based here in Los Angeles. It'll be my sixth year in April. So very, very grateful to have that platform to spread honey. As I say, my show is called The Honey Pot. Mama Bear, get it? And so I do that monthly every fourth Friday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. But I'm also a music curator, and I work with a company called Uncanned Music, and we have a lot of projects cooking. We do acoustic design for hospitality. So bars and restaurants, we build out their sound so it sounds amazing. And I also do playlist programming. So there might be a restaurant you're sitting in and I curated the playlist. Not an algorithm, not a robot, but a human like Mama Bear, like me.
Megan Pattison, DJ Mama Bear, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was so much fun chatting with you guys and chopping it up about the Queen.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong.
And me, Jocelyn Brown, sitting in for Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup. Heat Rocks is produced by myself, Morgan, and human Swiss Army knife Christian Duenas, who also engineers and edits our show.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, normally taping live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
Though currently, we're all taping safe from home. If you have a spare minute and haven't already done so, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, as it is a key way that new audience members can find their way to our humble podcast.
Please be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You can find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, heatrockspod.com.
That's where we'll post show notes for every episode, including a track listing of everything you've heard today and other goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com. Thanks for coming through, Jocelyn.
Thank you for having me on.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.